Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Wednesday at noon Central, 11 Mountain. So, of course, the Dakota political junkies are with us. First, joining us on the phone, John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. I'm glad to be here.
And then also with us from the SDPB Black Hills Bureau in Rapid City, Seth Tupper, Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter. Hey, Seth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Seth, I think John and I could just probably sit back and listen for the next 15 minutes while you tell us about Paul Erickson, because this is quite a piece that you wrote for the Rapid City Journal and quite a story. So give us the high points of what's going on with this South Dakotan and the ties, possible connection between the Trump campaign and the Russian government.
Yeah, so it kind of begins on December 3rd when the New York Times wrote a story about this email that somebody had sent to Rick Dearborn, who was a Trump campaign advisor during the 2016 campaign. And in that email, the sender reportedly said that he could arrange a back-channel meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And the Times revealed that the sender of this email was none other than Paul Erickson of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I didn't see that story right away. Somebody was kind enough to share it with me. And when they did, of course, I wondered, who is Paul Erickson? Well, that's got a very complicated answer, it turns out. And he's a guy who he grew up in Vermilion. He went to USD for a year, transferred to Yale, was on the leadership team of the National College Republicans with Jack Abramoff there, who went on to become the most notoriously corrupt lobbyist in American history, probably. He went on from there to do a bunch of other crazy things. He was the national political director for Pat Buchanan's first presidential campaign. He went from that, logically, into representing John Wayne Bobbitt after the Bobbitt incident, if people remember that, in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. He was an entertainment agent or lawyer, so to speak, for John Wayne Bobbitt. And there's many, many other facets, obviously, to Paul Erickson. But now he's caught up in this Trump-Russia investigation. And I guess most notably lately, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, the ranking Democrat in the Senate Judiciary Committee, has asked him to submit a bunch of documents and schedule an interview with the committee as part of their investigation into Russian meddling in the election.
So this isn't just a passing, he sent an email saying, hey, I can make this happen. There's potentially more to it than that.
Or not. Or not. Nobody really knows.
Right, exactly.
I did interview right. Paul Erickson, and he wouldn't speak on the record about anything to do really with the Trump-Russia investigations. We talked about his interesting personal history. That's the question with this guy. The other thing about him that I pointed out in the story, he's got kind of a sullied history in business, and he's got a number of judgments against him, and there have been a number of people who've sued him after getting into business with him in various different ventures. And so that's the question, is this guy really somebody who was going to connect, Trump and Putin? And,
right.
Or is this just a guy who sent an email? And or is it somewhere, there's the truth somewhere between there? And I guess that's what hopefully right. We'll find out as the investigators go forward.
John, as you hear this story or look at Seth's work on it, first of all, had you heard of Paul Erickson before? And second, what do you make of this?
Well, I'm not familiar with Paul Erickson, and I found Seth's story pretty interesting. What struck me is that there are probably all sorts of people who are kind of one layer below stuff that we hear, and that they're either ambitious and trying to get in the game or are actually in the game, and sometimes we don't know. And this might be one of those cases. So if he does submit documents to Senator Feinstein's committee, it'd be interesting to read those.
And Seth, you talked to other South Dakotans who know him and have an impression of him one way or the other?
Yeah, South Dakotans and people nationally, and quite honestly, most of the South Dakotans I spoke to have a pretty low opinion of him. And but what was interesting, and I think that's somewhat to do with his business history, but a lot of the South Dakotans I talked to also thought that he was kind of a liar or exaggerator about his many, you know, experiences. But most of those weird and crazy experiences that he talks about check out to be true. And so he's, like I said, he's a complicated figure. At least he appeared so to me. Some people would say, no, he's a simple figure. He's just a fill in the derogatory term, I guess. But, right.
What Lee Schoenbeck called him, former lawmaker Lee Schoenbeck, what do you call him, slimy? Or
he said he was the biggest phony he'd ever met in South Dakota
phony.
Politics.
Oh, yeah. How could I forget the word phony? That's what it was. What a good word. He's a phony.
On the other hand, I quoted a national political commentator who said that this guy was basically a secret, powerful manipulator of the political universe. So,
So
again, which is true, maybe a little bit of both. I'm not sure.
Fun with politics. RapidCityJournal.com is where you can read that work by Seth if you don't already subscribe to the newspaper. Let's jump over to the news out of Pierre. John Hunter, let's start with you because, the budget projections are coming in. Lee Strubinger is going to talk with us in a little bit to unpack the numbers piece by piece. But what are your initial impressions about maybe now a little more money in play than we thought, John?
Well, it's a process that occurs every year, and that is when the governor presents his budget address in December, he has one set of forecasts, and then by the time you get to early February, a couple more months have passed, so you have a couple more months of actual results, and maybe that would indicate trends either accelerating or decelerating or going in a different direction. And so it's really a moving target. Remember, the budget that they're working on is the one that starts July 1st. So even after it, this would get passed in February, you still have several months to go before the thing even starts. So, but they do also make forecasts, of course, about what has to happen the rest of this year, and they have to take action on that to make sure that we make ends meet as well. So in this year, sometimes governors may be conservative on their forecast or use those forecasts in a conservative manner, or they may say, no, I think it's going to be strong and propose additional spending. I think Governor Dugard has generally been conservative with those. And so if you do get a change in forecast, you hope it would be toward the positive thing, and that's what's happened this year. So what turned out to be a pretty austere budget, or at least very flat with previous years, turns out may have a little bit, and it's not a bad place to be. I think people descend on Pierre asking for money for programs and salaries and all sorts of, education and so forth. And so now maybe some of this can be passed out without having to raise any taxes or have any other fiscal challenges.
So, John, when I have my personal budget and things are a little tight, I, make this separate kind of wish list with my priorities. And if I had a little extra money, then I would tackle the top priority on that list because, I'm organized. Is state government like that, where they have an idea like right away, okay, this is the first thing that we need to take care of because it hurt the most to not be able to fund it? Or is it a free-for-all of everybody coming in and saying, we heard that the projections are stronger than expected. Let's put it here.
No, I think they have fully adopted the Lori Walsh method.
Oh, excellent. Well,
copyrighted yet, but it should be. I think.
Let's hope.
South Dakota's budget is so dominated by a few line items: education, state salaries. There's kind of a few things that really K-12 Regents. That they kind of dominated. So when you do have extra money for that, you could do a lot of little small things, or you could do something maybe small to a big item. So, you could, with that extra money that would come in, you could probably start a new little program, but they say, no, why don't we put that toward making a little progress on these? And when I think when people provide feedback to their legislators, maybe on that Cracker Barrels, which have been occurring a lot this session, the constituents will say, look, I think state employees deserve a small raise, or I think K-12 deserves a little bump, or I think let's put a little toward that. And they get their feedback from that. But I would guess it would probably fold into one of those larger items, specifically those top two that said, look, there's no money for increase at all this year, maybe a little right. bit something there.
And Seth, when I talked to Governor Dugard right after the budget address, I asked him about his concerns about retention among state employees, and he said it was a priority at that point. Do you anticipate that might be one of the first things that we look at, is sort of figuring out in the state employee realm, looking at a cost of living increase?
I would sure think so. It seemed like the governor was asking, you know, state employees to sacrifice a little bit in a tight budget situation. And so when the information comes to light that the budget situation isn't as tight as maybe he thought, it's pretty hard not to go back then and relieve some of that sacrifice. So I would guess that'd be one of the first places to look.
All right, Seth. Stick with the money and the dollar signs, because you recently talked with Congresswoman Kristi Noem, and the conversation turned to tax reform. And give me a little idea. This is for the podcast, right?
Yeah. We had her on our Mount Podmore podcast. She was out here for the Black Hills Stock Show, so we got to catch up mm-hmm. there in person.
So. All right, we've got a little clip, and this is Seth asking Congresswoman Noem about sort of finding her way onto the committee to discuss tax reform and how she was able to get that leadership position. Here she is.
And when it came to being on that conference committee, you know, I went to the speaker, said, would you please put me on the conference committee to negotiate tax? He said, no, absolutely not. I will not put you on there. And I said, why is that? And he said, because you care too much about the death tax. He said, I'm worried that you won't contribute to all the discussion, that you'll only focus on the death tax. And then if we don't repeal the death tax, that you won't vote for the bill. And I said, listen, I care passionately about repealing this un-American tax. But I also care passionately about making sure our small business tax code works, that our family tax credit is going to benefit those folks that are low and middle income. Mm-hmm. I'll contribute to every part of the conversation. Then my chairman that had worked with me for the last 3 years, you know, went to the speaker and advocated for me to be there as well.
That's Congresswoman Kristi Noem talking with Seth Tupper on the Mount Podmore podcast. Am I saying that right? Tangled in that. So there's South Dakotans who thought that Congresswoman Noem cared too much about the death tax. Speaker Ryan echoed some of those concerns, but they were able to overcome it. So did that surprise you, Seth, that sort of behind-the-scenes look?
Yeah, I don't know if it surprised me, but I thought it certainly was interesting. And the context of getting to that answer was that I had been asking Representative Noem a little bit about, you know, her thoughts on how Washington works compared to her time in the legislature. And, you know, she's going to be leaving Congress, you know, after this term, no matter what, because she's running for governor. And she had been talking about how Washington moves on relationships, as opposed to at the Capitol and Pier, where you file a bill and it gets a hearing no matter what, and everybody gets, every bill basically gets a fair shake. In Washington, she was saying, if you don't have the right relationships, you won't get anything done. And this was an example she was citing, where, according to her, she'd been able to develop the kind of relationships to basically lobby her way on to an important committee that ended up, you know, finalizing the draft of the tax reform bill that got passed into law.
I want to jump ahead a little bit and expand on that idea of building relationships. Don Hunter, the idea for having independents voting, the open primaries conversation is still going on, but it's sort of stalled in the South Dakota House of Representatives. This is something that kind of comes up frequently and is now going nowhere. What are your thoughts on open primaries and the relationships that would need to be built to sort of see that move forward?
Well, I think it's a fascinating topic, and it's historical in nature, really, in the fact that our country has had political parties like this for its entire history. And I think some people say that's it's effective, and other people say it's part of the problem of maybe ineffective government today. So I think the things that they're proposing about open primaries really is kind of chipping away a little bit at the edges. It doesn't eliminate the party system. It doesn't eliminate any of that kind of stuff. But it does maybe allow for different things to be happening at the primary level, where people could vote in other people's primaries. So a non-member could vote to nominate someone from a particular party. In one sense, it seems wrong, and the fact that, you know, it's like if you belong to the Rotary Club in Madison, and you'd have someone from the Lions Club go over and vote for who your president should be in the Rotary, and that doesn't seem to make sense. On the other hand, other people might say, "Look, this is America. We're electing public officials that will rule or legislate on behalf of all of us. Why should just a certain number of people who sign this card be the one to participate?" I'm not going to go on too many hours with this because I think you certainly right. could. But you know, there is a lot of partisanship in these primary elections, and the fact that some people say, and I'm one of them, that you have to be more extreme to be nominated and you have to be more moderate to be elected in a general election. So far, our parties generally elect someone maybe a little, you know, a Republican primary might elect someone who is farther right, and a Democratic primary might go left, and then they face off, and who races to the middle fastest. It's not an ideal situation. So, right. Yeah, there are a lot of elements to it. I don't anticipate changes right now, but as long as some of the problems we have in Washington and sometimes in Pierre having to do with parties, I think they'll continue to propose changes to try to improve it.
Interesting stuff. Our time is short today, so we're going to have to say farewell. But John Hunter, publisher of Madison Daily Leader, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Seth Tupper, Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter. Find him at rapidcityjournal.com. Seth, thanks for being here as well.
You're welcome.
Thanks to our friends at the Black Hills Surgical Hospital for helping us bring you conversations and content from the Black Hills area.